This week on the Woven Energy Podcast.
So if you like, Delgek is like an in-your-face kind of shamanistic technique. A constant beat of a drum, you know, boom, 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 like that. As a point of focus for your thoughts to take those thoughts from a complex place to a simple place. The beat of the drum, as used in Bukin Hengrek, which is a shamanic technique. The other one is an exercise. And let's be very, very clear that we don't confuse those two things. In the whole of shamanism, Delgek is so obvious, it's powerful. It's like a wave. You're not thinking. You're just not you're not thinking. Yeah, you're not kind of thinking any kind of thoughts. So effectively, you're moving between haftas and tirukh, between the two positions, these two very, very fundamental basic positions. And you see some shamans doing this, and it's amazing. You know, it's amazing how they manage to, you know, it just looks so powerful. It, in my eyes, a subject area that attracts miasma. Yeah. I guess like flypaper attracts flies, you know, it's like, you know, it's almost like a magnet. Yeah. You know, am I breathing in? Am I breathing out? That's not the answer to the question. The answer to the question is, how does your breath lock into that motion? Take Bukin Hengrek as your base technique. That's your foundation for Amska. And then pick one of the other ones, yeah? Bonfire is no different from that. The bonfire itself would teach you when you get on with Dalgek. The bonfire itself teaches you because the bonfire is a living thing. It's an energy change, you know? And as you're probably trying to realize, all this stuff is all about energy change.
Hey guys, and welcome to the Woven Energy Podcast. This is episode 18. I'm Joseph Sikora, and I'm here with Damon Smith to talk about shamanism from the ground up. And today we're going to carry on looking at stage two of learning shamanism, and we're going to go into some practical exercises to develop that stage. It's called the Amska, which means the breath. And to reiterate once again, learning stage one is so, so important here before moving on to stage two. That's stage one being Chalicity. And our series on Chalicity, which are must-listen episodes, are episodes 7, 8, and 9. Now, I, as well as many of you, I hope, went off and enthusiastically bought a shaman's drum. Mine's an octagonal one and fairly big. It's very plain and simple, but and it should be arriving through the post today. I just hope it smells good. We know that's important from last episode. If you haven't listened yet, please do. It's pretty much a full episode, a full practical episode, but there is also a lot of good stuff in there about the shaman's drum and what to look for and how to choose one, how to hold it, etc., etc. So, Damon, Chalicity, let's say we have our drum and we are getting there with Chalicity, but not quite there yet. You said in passing last episode that it's fine if you are practicing your Chalicity as well as the Amska using the Bukin Hengrek technique. So to kick this episode off, would you clarify that and how we could practice our foundation using the drum?
I do need to clarify that because it's not fine. In the Bukin Hengrek technique, it's not fine. Let's be clear. Two separate techniques. One technique is level one, if you like, practicing your Chalicity. You use the constant beat of a drum, you know, boom, 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 like that, as a point of focus for your thoughts to take those thoughts from a complex place to a simple place, as a stepping stone towards achieving Chalicity, which would be no thought for the past, no thought for the future, hanging in the moment, you're empty of thoughts, including the thoughts about focusing on the beat of a drum or counting or something like that. That's what I said is okay. But that has nothing to do with Bukin Hengrek, other than it's a stepping stone to the state of Chalicity, which is kind of a mandatory prerequisite for being able to attempt Bukin Hengrek, which is not that. So if you think about it, in that exercise, you're using the beat of a drum, you're using the beat of a drum, and that is an exercise. It's not a technique.
Okay? Yeah. It's just steady rhythm.
It's got nothing to do with your breathing. It's got nothing to do with your heart rate or anything of that nature. It's just a steady rhythm that you're using to, as a point of focus, to take your thoughts from all the complexity of your life, you know, your job and your the things that you do and the things you're concerned about, to take your thoughts away from that and onto this constant steady beat. That is taking your thoughts from the place of complex to simple, and then that acts as a stepping stone from the place of simple to not at all. In terms of
so thinking. As an exercise, then it's purely and simply because of the rhythmic nature of the drum, which could be the rhythmic nature of anything, not just a drum.
Yeah, metronome,
the drum's a convenient
anything at
tool.
All. Yeah.
And it's that rhythmic nature which distracts us.
Yes, but that has nothing to do with Amsgar. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely cellisti has to do with Amsgar, and it's a trick. It's not even a technique, it's a trick you can use to help you improve your cellisti. But it is even within level one, it's a stepping stone. So what I would say is that trick, if you need that trick, you still haven't reached the end of level one, let alone the start of level two.
So is there a definite point at which somebody could go, I have now achieved cellisti, I'm now ready to move on to stage two? Or is it a fluid...
If you're thinking like that, then you definitely haven't.
Is it a fluid...
It's a very, very obvious state. It's a very, very obvious state when you're in cellisti. Yeah. There's no doubt over it. Mm-hmm. Because the baseline is not involved and doubt and things like that, they're of the baseline, those things, you know. So if you're thinking stuff like that, then you're probably not in a state of cellisti. You're not thinking. You're just not you're not thinking. Yeah. You're not kind of thinking any kind of thoughts. You are have a degree of emptiness in terms of the baseline. But it's not like you're completely empty and devoid of anything. There's an energy inside you. There's a spirit inside you. And actually going into cellisti tends to bring that to the fore. It doesn't suppress that. It actually brings it to the fore. And as I think the best way to think about it is, you know, as we talked about doing booking Hengleg on the heartbeat last time.
Yeah.
Things like your heartbeat, that they, when you're in a state of cellisti, they become increasingly obvious. The better you get at cellisti, things like that, they become very obvious. Things that were subtle, and this is the whole point, isn't it? This is what we said shamans do. Shamans pick up on subtle cues within nature, and a starting point for that, which is the idea behind Amsgar, is that your body is the closest part of nature to you, so there's the starting point. I found that, you know, the cellisti exercise where we stand overlooking a lake or the sea or something like that with our in the embracing position. Incidentally, you know, we said the folded wings position is called Havtas. The embracing position is called Teirucht. We'll gradually sneak Mongol words up on people as these podcasts proceed to this, you know. But when you're in the tail position, and you are, you know, we said allowing everything to come to you, the sound, the smell, the feeling of the wind and the if it's raining or whatever, the wave, rain or the snow, and all that stuff on your body, all those things come equally. The movement of the waves or the ripples in the water, all of that stuff comes to you equally. Birds flying across the sky, it all comes equally. It's all welcome.
And we're not distinguishing
accepted.
One from
exactly.
the other. You know, a bird flies across
and
the sky. We're not thinking a bird flies across the sky.
Exactly. That's how you tell that. That's one of the ways you can tell if you're in the state of cellisti, but it is that you're not distinguishing. But the thing is, if you start thinking like, am I in a state of cellisti, not in a state of cellisti.
Well, do you know, for me, I think, and I think this might be a stage a few people get to eventually, but for me, I don't think I'm there where I can switch it on. I think it takes me a good amount of time to drop into it. Sure. And then it disappears.
It's difficult,
so I think,
but just remember, it's what you said. It's like it's coins in your piggy bank. Cellisti is difficult. What I would say is that cellisti is also obvious. when you're in a state of chelicity, a strong state of chelicity, you know, there are matters of degree in this stuff, aren't there? Yeah. But when you're in a strong state of chelicity, it's a very obvious state. It's not anything that there would be any questioning over. There's no need to question something that's so obvious. It's that chelicity is something, as we've said, you have to work on for your entire life, and it gets eroded. The miasma erodes chelicity continuously. And so you're, in some ways, as a member of a civilized society, we're all trying to shore up our dam of, you know, it's like stick fingers in the increasingly large number of holes in the dam, you know. The chelicity is vitally important. So what I would say is that, I don't want to put a time on it because it makes it pointless, but I would say, just hypothetical, 2 minutes. If it takes you more than 2 minutes to drop into chelicity, then there's probably no value in going on to Amskar yet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It takes one. If it takes less than 2 minutes, there's probably some degree of value you can derive from that. But 2 minutes, you know, to me, I can switch chelicity on instantly. To me, 2 minutes is a very long time.
You should switch into chelicity. When I'm there, I'll switch into chelicity, and then we'll try one of these podcast episodes.
We have a chelicity race. That's going to be, if we were to do that in a non-joking way, that would be something along the lines of automatic writing or something along the lines of Maiza. Maiza is a shamanistic practice that's practiced all over the world. That's the Japanese name for it. And effectively the shaman goes into what Westerners would describe as a trance. Which is effectively an extremely deep state of chelicity. It's a technique. There's a technique involved in this. And again, psychoactive substances might be used for that, or some other, sometimes a mirror is used for that. Various other things are used for that. They go into very deep, and then somebody who sits in front of them. This is why it's called Maiza. Maiza means front sitting or sitting in front. Yeah. Ask them questions, and they use one of two shamanistic states, one of which is called Kamiroshi and one of which is called Kamigakari. And these two states, they're different from each other, but effectively they are higher level states beyond stage two. And these states enable the shaman to give feedback in the manner that would be described as an oracle, you know, like the Oracle of Delphi. That feedback is in a form of something like, oh, your ancestor is happy in heaven and he says everything's going to be okay and don't worry, then you know that's bullshit. The feedback through, and we talked about speaking in tongues. This is the same kind of thing. You know, I said that's a shamanistic practice that's in the New Testament. It sounds very shamanistic. And it's something that's widely used today in more esoteric Christian groups, and it is very shamanistic in its nature. That is driven by the underlying spirit of nature. The words that come out are not normal language, and they're not easily comprehensible in that practice of Maiza. That's true whether it's done Kamiroshi or Kamigakari. Either way, it's true. So. The Woven Energy Podcast is a baseline activity. I wasn't keen on starting this up for that reason. It would be an interesting exercise, but you probably won't want to release the episode after we've done it. That's the best way to put it.
I'm fascinated when you're saying that the words in that shamanistic state, the words they're not words. They're just sounds.
They're often sounds. There may be some words, but it's what people would call, people who are miasmatic in their worldview, they would call it mystical or cryptic or something like that. You know, if there are indeed words that are recognizable within it. But the bottom line is that's the spirit of nature driving the activity. And I guess once we get onto the later levels, sort of, this is kind of level 3/4 after we've done the spirit dance, which is obviously my main focus, we could do something on Maiza, you know. Mm. Maiza in a way, especially the Kamigakari form of it, is almost like a higher level. It's almost like an alternative method to the spirit journey. It's an equally deep shamanic state, but it's very different from the spirit journey. I guess to me, in a way, it's not different, but I think the experience of it is very different. It's actually a similar kind of thing. I'm not a fan of Maiza for one very good reason, is that the amount, I mean, for instance, there are certain mountains in Japan that are associated with Maiza, the practice of Maiza, Mount Ontake, Mount Hayachine, these sort of mountains, and there's a, just a colossal amount of miasma has been heaped upon the general idea of Maiza over the generations. That's probably the best way to put it. Yeah. And Maiza is a subject area that attracts miasma. Yeah. I guess like flypaper attracts flies, you know, it's like, you know, it's almost like a magnet. Yeah. And because the temptation for the miasma to use that as a tool of social engineering is just far too strong. The reason I like spirit dance, one of the reasons why I love spirit dance, is that you know, all shamanistic practices have a certain level of magnetism for the miasma, especially when we practice them in a society like ours. But that spirit dance has less magnetic force than does Maiza, yeah, for instance.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I like it.
Cool.
Yeah. Just to recap. Let's keep separate for now the idea that you use the beat of a drum as a stepping stone to achieving chelicity. That's one thing.
Yeah.
And the beat of the drum as used in Buki and Hengreg, which is a shamanic technique. The other one is an exercise. And let's be very, very clear that we don't confuse those two things.
Fantastic. You said in stage two, last episode, this is the first proper technique. And people develop it very far, so they take that technique to extreme levels.
Yeah.
As far as our stages go, does that mean people develop it beyond stage two, or does it still stay as stage two that becomes a lot more concrete and solid and a lot more valuable in terms of its...
Yes, the latter. Just like chelicity, you know, we talked about the pagoda. But it's not a good analogy, really, because as we said, chelicity extends up, or if you want to call it up, chelicity embraces or extends up through all of the other levels of learning to be a shaman. It extends through all of them, and it's there in all of them. And in a way, it is all of them. The same with Amskar. Can you practice chelicity without practicing Amskar level techniques? Yes, you can. Can you practice Amskar level techniques without practicing chelicity? No, you can't. That's impossible, because Amskar is a further embracing. Amskar is embraced within. And so as we go through each of the levels in the shamanistic pagoda, effectively what happens is you start at chelicity. You start with chelicity. So this is level 2 up to level 7, if you like. You start with chelicity. You take on and habituate the technique. you move away from Chelicity in doing so, because that's inevitable. Learning a new technique, you're going to get dragged to the baseline to a certain extent. Then it becomes habituated and you return to Chelicity in the same way that a wave washes up the beach and then rolls back to the sea. The water then rolls back to the sea at every one of those levels. But every time you pick up something and then your next wave, as you go up to the next level and then habituate and come back to Chelicity, you're picking up something more. So for instance, at the first two levels, you could think Chelicity, that's the incoming wave. The wave rolls up the beach. It picks up some of the sand. It rolls back down the beach, picking up more of the sand. And then the next time it rolls up the beach would be Amskirt. It's already got some of that sand in it. Yeah. And then it picks up moss and so on. Yeah, that's kind of the analogy. And so every new level that we go through, we leave Chelicity while learning the technique. And then we return to Chelicity once the technique has become habituated. That's really how it works. And so as you go up the levels, Chelicity comes with you. It doesn't. It almost like you pull it up, yeah? So you go up to stage two and then you hoist Chelicity up with you and then you work it. When it's there, then you start working. Then you can work on stage three and you hoist Chelicity up with you. And when it's there, that's probably quite a good analogy, yeah? And the when it's there is important, yeah? If it's not there, then you need to be back down the pagoda.
Back down the pagoda. back to level one.
Yeah. But of course, you know, if you think of that analogy as you're hoisting the Chelicity up, it's not black or white. You know, the Chelicity is coming up.
Yeah. You know,
and it's in transition, and you can probably, once it's just about there, you can start making some use of the layer you're looking at.
Myself included, it's so hard to stop thinking in terms of this or that or black or white or binary. You know, it's either this or that. And it really is just like we said last episode, it's a big hug. It's a big embrace.
Yeah, big embrace. Yeah, you would have been in a better position if you were the one who were resisting doing the podcast originally. And I was trying to ask you to do it. You would be explaining this to me. Yeah. Because obviously, you know, this Wolfen Energy podcast, although I think that potentially it has some positive benefits. I think it has some positive benefits potentially. It is entirely, virtually entirely off the baseline, unless we can persuade people who are listening to it to go away and actually practice this stuff and actually
I
hope we are doing it, but again, I would take that as an aspiration. Yeah. I would take that as an aspiration. I wouldn't take it as an assumption. And you know, maybe there's more things we can over time. Maybe there's more things we can think that we can do to encourage
to help.
That.
Yeah.
But if that doesn't happen, then we've wasted hours and hours and hours of discussion. That's why.
But you know what? That's not true though, Dermot. Because I think it's a tool. The podcast become a tool that people can use. You know, if you've got a book of how to learn the piano in front of you, it doesn't mean you can learn the piano. You have to sit there, open it, and practice.
Exactly, absolutely. And the piano won't do anything if you don't. I don't know, some of these modern pianos will.
No, but push a button and it's all there for you. But that's another problem.
As long as it's an old-fashioned piano. Yeah, and it's just like that. It's just like that.
Magic bullet mentality. That's another thing to fight against. But anyway, fantastic. Well, so stage two, where we left it last episode, you described as following but with a caveat, following the breath and then following the heart, but not following the breath and not following the heart. You know what I mean?
Yeah, with the heart and with the breath.
Heart and with the breath. Is there anything you want to solidify with that before you move on?
No, I think we give it a pretty decent description last time. One of the things that I wanted to make clear is when I said you incline your head down towards the drum, I didn't mean you stuck your head literally into the drum. Yeah. Mm. I thought that was probably clear enough.
I've watched quite a few
YouTube
videos.
Your head is
not
physically in the drum. It's just your face is close enough that some of the air that you're breathing is coming out of the drum. Yeah.
I watched quite a few Mongo, YouTube videos, and it does look like the head's not inside the drum. Just
no, it's not. I didn't want to give the impression that it's inside the... I did say it's not bent at a 90-degree angle or you have to stretch underneath something. And actually, if you your tension cords are the layout that I've recommended, you won't be able to put your head inside the drum. It won't be possible. The hurt layout, the cords are in your way if you're trying to do that. What I could do is I wanted to describe a third level of that, which I decided not to, I think for good reason. But I'd give you an alternative, third level of that, which is just a little hint of spirit dance. Which is when you've managed to habituate it on the heartbeat, on the heart rate, there's a next exercise you can do, which is good for practicing preparatory work for spirit dance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is not particularly preparatory work for anything other than spirit dance. So when we're talking about going to level three, this is preparatory work for spirit dance, pretty much as your, anyway, spirit dance isn't one technique. It's a whole host of techniques. Yeah. One in, within shamanism, my feeling is that spirit dance, the subject of spirit dance covers a very substantive proportion of all the techniques. I don't know what the percentage would be, you know, it's certainly not 50%, but a substantive proportion of all the techniques. And so again, we shouldn't really call it one thing. You know, it's actually lots and lots of different things. But anyway, the thing that you can do, which will be good preparation for that, is every three heartbeats, you flip the drum from the grip that we're using, which is what I would call an outside grip. That's you're holding the drum in the half-tast position. That is with, so the membrane of the drum is outside the back of your left forearm, facing away from you. And your beating of the drum is coming in towards your body, again in the half-tast position, with the right hand striking the drum in a motion that's inwards towards your body. The other side of the half-tast position is the reverse grip. To flip the drum, you move your left forearm away from you and you rotate, you allow the central point of the hurt layout. This is one of the reasons why I recommend the hurt layout, because other layouts you can't do this. Mm. You allow that central point as a point of pivot, and in that motion, the drum quite naturally, so we're not, the drum is turning itself. You simply move your hand away from you and the drum turns itself. The center point of the hurt layout is rotating between your left index finger and your left thumb, and the drum will quite naturally come so that the membrane lies along the inside of your left forearm. And again, you're back in the folded wings position, but this time the left arm has become the outer wing and you're beating the drum from the inside with the inner wing. And so the technique is that every three heartbeats, it doesn't have to be three, just three seems like quite a nice beat to do it on. And every three heartbeats, you flip the drum from the inside to the outside. But as you start to habituate that, and obviously when it's on the inside, you continue beating, then you flip to the outside, you continue beating with the heart. Mm. But practicing the ability to flip the membrane of the drum, which is actually called Hengrik. You know, this technique is called Buchking Hengrik. Hengrik means like a membrane. The membrane of the drum is then facing in towards you and you're beating outwards, but you're still in the half-tast position because your left arm is now the outer arm. If it's on your left hand, you know, as we've said, if you're practicing your torsional teen, it'll be on the other side. Yeah. And you're just flipping it out in every three heartbeats. And that's not particularly useful. And you want to habituate that so that you don't have to think about it again. You don't have to think about it. It's not particularly useful for level two practice, but it's great preparatory work. You can do it while practicing your level two, and it's great preparatory work for level three. if you're doing spirit dance with the drum, you need to be able to move the drum around without thought, without thinking. And that ability to flip the membrane from the inside to outside, it's both a half task position. It's the same position with it on the inside. So the original one we described is what I call the outside grip. If it's on the inside grip, your half task position is slightly more open so that it makes it easier for you to beat the drum, but it's still the same. It's still the same position. Yeah.
So we're holding the drum. It's in our left hand. Our right hand's over the top. We're in the half task position. The left arm moves outwards to allow the drum to rotate. Mine's 60 centimetres diameter, so that's going to come out quite a bit, right?
Ah, it's easy enough. 60 centimetres is nothing, mate.
Okay. And then you flip it via the, what were the cords called again? The middle
section.
Well,
the layout is called hurt.
The hurt.
It's the centre of hurt.
And the drum pivots across that central
point.
And then so the membrane then is, instead of pointing away from me, is pointing towards me. And then my right hand comes underneath with the beater and starts.
Well, move your right arm. Your right arm, you don't move it. When you get used to this, habituated. Your right arm just moves out the way as you do the flip. Yeah. It's quite easy. Yeah. It's quite easy. The tricky bit is actually the making sure that your fingers don't get caught up in the cords as you do it. That's really what needs to practice. Actually, that you'll find the flipping thing is not difficult.
All right, cool. Yeah. So I think it's just needs,
as long
needs
as
to
you're
try
using
it.
The hurt, as long as you're using the hurt layout, and the reason it's easy is because your hand is at the central pivot point of the drum. You're at the center of balance of the drum. If you use any of the other, you know, like you got a deer antler inside, or there's a special gripping part, or something like that, or the rod goes across and it's not in the center, then that will make your life much more difficult.
Well, I think mine's a cross in the middle. It's simply just
cross. Which is fine. That'll you're less likely to get your fingers caught up in the cords with that. Yeah.
All right. Cool. Okay. So that's extending last week's Bukic Hendrik technique. Do you want to carry on? Because I remember you saying at one point, I could go on for episode after episode after episode for Amsgar techniques. So do you want to show us some more?
Let's do some more. But just be clear, okay? Now we're given a bit of variety. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean, what I wouldn't recommend is that you go away and practice all of these. Shamanism is a flavorsome and varied subject. My recommendation is that I'm giving you a number of alternatives so that you can find one that sits well with you. It's not so that you can run away, do, you know, 2 minutes on this one, 2 minutes on this one, 2 minutes on this one.
It's much better to pick one and run with it. And try and go deep with that. Yeah.
And the one that we've described, what I would say is a good thing for practice would be, for instance, a good strategy would be take Bukic Hendrik as your base technique. That's your foundation for Amsgar. Mm. And then pick one of the other ones. Yeah. Yeah. And practice those two. There would be an approach. You know, nothing's set in stone. Nothing's set in stone, but there would be an approach, would be reasonable.
Bukic Hendrik being the technique which encompasses all you've talked so far, including the heartbeat and including the...
Another technique is called Delgech. And this is another one that's quite famous, you know, as we said, famous in the tiny little shamanistic circles. My warning with Delgech is that it's not good if you've got a bad back. So if you do have a bad back, pick another one. Basically this one, Bukic Hendrik is done in the half-task position. This one is from the Tirith position. So Tirith is you're standing, you know, like the famous woven energy picture. I don't know if it's famous now, but somebody's probably seen it. You're standing with your hands wide. And also for this one, you want your feet reasonably wide apart. This one, okay, so it's the way it's famous is it's done with a bonfire. Yeah. So,
okay.
But you don't need a bonfire. Okay. You can practice that because it's a bit impractical in this day and age. It's lovely to do with a bonfire. Absolutely lovely. But you don't need one. And it does add something to it, but the technique is certainly instructive. You can certainly learn stuff through it by doing it without any bonfire at all. So, first level of Delgich, you stand in the Teorich position, the embracing position.
Let's just say that once more. So it's feet apart, it's hands apart, palms facing upwards.
Your feet, you know what I said when you do Teorich the previous time? We talked it as the embracing nature position or something like that.
Yeah.
When we talked about it last time, I think was during the Tillin exercise.
Yeah, episode 8.
We said you don't have to put your feet too wide. For Delgich, you do want your feet reasonably, you definitely want them wider than shoulder width.
Okay.
And your knees quite well bent.
Okay.
So you embrace nature. You, surprise, surprise, enter a state of chillicity. For all of these techniques, I'm going to say that on every single one of them, so just expect it from now.
Yeah.
You enter a state of chillicity, or maybe you've been in that position. The way I do Delgich is very often I've been practicing my chillicity in the Teorich position, and I'll just spontaneously enter the Delgich technique. It'll just start. It's not that I decide to do it or anything. It'll just start because I have habituated it. It's one that I use a lot because it's also a technique that's transferable to spirit dance. I'm going to explain the movement and then we'll talk about the breath.
Yeah.
You drop your head and upper body from the waist forwards.
Okay.
Towards, say, the front left. Again, you know, torsional teen, front right, towards the front left, for instance. This is coming from the Teorich position. So you drop your upper body towards the front left. As you do that, you then swing your body across low towards the front right. As that happens, you enter a low version of the folded wings position. Your left hand and your right hand come in just like they do in the Tillin exercise when you form the folded wings position. But this time the wrists would be crossed downwards rather than upwards. And your hand comes in. And then using the momentum, that momentum comes back across to the left where you started like a wave. So it's like a wave. And you come upright again. You come upright, and as you do that, your left arm unfurls. The unfurl is the way I would describe it. It comes over, and it unfurls back out to the left. So the left hand comes up the right side of your body, over your head, and then out back into the Teorich position, out to the left. At the same time, the right hand also reforms the Teorich position. So we've made like the wave on the beach that we're talking about in the last exercise. We're sort of doing rather than a spiritual version of it. Now we're doing because breathing is like a wave. Breathing is like a wave. You know, I said the breath builds and it sort of ebbs and flows and it changes like a wave.
Yeah.
So here we're emulating, if you like, the wave on the beach. The water rolls back down the beach. That's where the water, say the previous wave crashed on the beach. Your left front is that position. So you drop down, you're the water. And now it rolls back down the beach into the sea. And then the sea picks the wave up and it comes up and over and then out to your left side again. It like splashes, the wave splashes, it breaks on the beach and you're back in the tear-off position. Now, then you simply repeat your upper body and head drop at the waist to your front right. The front right, when I'm saying dropping, I mean, you see some shamans doing this and their head's virtually touching the floor, even though they're standing up. You definitely don't need to go that low. But you know, just above your waist is probably good enough for your head. Yeah. It's definitely an exercise that's not good if you have physical.
Mm. Well, it sounds like one that would be quite problems. Fast.
No, we're going to come on to how fast it is in a moment, mate. It's not that fast. Okay. But it's definitely has a sense of a wave. It's like a wave breaking on the beach. So now we go down to the right, we come back across the left, we do tilling low. The folded wings position low from tilling.
But then our palms are down, not towards us.
Our palms are towards us. Towards us. Yeah, it's exactly that thing. I mean, the thing with the folded wings position is that it doesn't matter where the hand, what height the hands are, it's still the folded wings position. So they're crossed over, and they're down to the front right now. They're down to the front right, and then they come up and over and open like a wave. And it's like a wave breaking, and it's a continuous action. The dropping then off the open position, the dropping then smoothly occurs again. You're back into the folded wings. So effectively, you're moving between haftas and tirioch, between the two positions, these two very, very fundamental basic positions. You're moving between those two positions as a continuous ebb and flow of water, like a wave running back down the beach. The sea picks it up and breaks it back on the beach. It's a very, very powerful exercise, Delgach. You can really feel the spirit come through. If you're in a good, deep state of chalisti, it's a very powerful exercise. And although I said don't do it if you have a bad back, if you don't have a bad back, this will give you a strong back. That's one of the health benefits of it. Yeah. It will give you a strong back. And you see some shamans doing this, and it's amazing. You know, it's amazing how they manage to, you know, it just looks so powerful. Those guys have strong backs. That's not why they're doing the Delgach exercise, but it's a consequence. It's a possibly unintended consequence of practicing that exercise quite a lot.
If at all possible, could you find a video on YouTube that we could put in the show notes at all?
I don't know, mate. I tell you what it was on. You remember that one we talked about and it was, and then it was actually deleted by the time we came to release the podcast. It was on that.
Right.
Among other things, there were a few things on that video, but it was used among other things on that.
I think I've seen something resembling what you're talking about when they use the actual drum as well. Is that correct?
Yes, they use the drum as well. Yeah. Well, as we've said, you can use the drum in pretty much any technique. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I think on that one, the guy was using the drum as well. But practice it with this one. For this one, practice it without the drum first, so you get the feeling. Yeah, practice it without the drum, and then once you've internalized the feeling, once you've habituated it, then doing it with the drum is simply doing it with a drum in your hand. Either drum's in your hand or it's not. There's no difference.
Yeah. So we're starting off. Our feet are more than shoulder width apart. With our knees are bent, and we're starting off by going to the left.
Don't start off going left. I use left as an example. Yeah. Let's keep Toshil Teen in this. Whichever side you want.
Whatever side you want. But the point is it changes between each one. Yeah. So if we did start on the left, the next one would be starting on the right and then it would be
It might. But it doesn't work like when you get into it, it doesn't work like that. Sometimes you find you might do two on the left, three on the left, and then one on the right. You know, it just, the whole point of Delgach is it wants it to be the satel driving you. The underlying spirit is driving you. So you do what you feel. Yeah. You do what you feel. But to start off with, when you're practicing the technique, yeah, first one on the left, next one on the right, next one on the left, next one on the right, yeah. But that's not where you're going with it. That's just learning the technique. Yeah.
Oh, that's fine.
But there's no wrong side. That's what I'm saying. There's no wrong side. If you think there's a wrong side, then you're misunderstanding what we're trying to do.
The only thing I'm a bit unclear about is the arms, what the arms are doing.
Okay, so the right arm. Let's say I'm starting to the left.
I can't stand up and do this because I'm in front of the mic. I'll sound like an echo chamber.
So I bend at the waist. I drop at the waist. This is why you want your legs wide. If you start doing that with your legs straight, wide and bent, if you do that with your legs straight, you will hurt your back. You drop at the waist down to the front left. So say I'm doing that. So here in this position, my hands are my palm in towards my left knee. Yeah. My both hands are crossed over at the wrists and they're palm into, it's not exact. Yeah. But I'm just giving you roughly. Yeah. They're roughly palms in towards the left knee, around the left knee somewhere. Yeah. Typically there I would have my, right hand outside my left hand. That's because that's just my habituated drumming position, but there's absolutely no problem at all having your left hand outside your right hand. None whatsoever. So don't get caught up on stuff like that. But yeah. The palms are inwards, right? Okay. My hands stay low. I now use my waist and my body with the momentum to swing back. It's like using the momentum of my body dropping. So the momentum of my body bending and dropping towards the front left, that has a momentum. I don't allow that momentum to stop. I turn it into a curve that goes across. So my hands are now across at my right knee. Yeah?
Yeah.
I use that momentum to continue a circle so that my hands are now coming up. And now they're coming up into the upper level half-task position. That is with the wrists crossed, you know, the normal half-task position, yeah?
Yeah.
But instead of being crossed straight in front of my chest, they're crossed in front of my right shoulder, yeah? Yeah. As if I'm holding a drum, exactly as if I'm holding a drum, yeah? And now they continue to rise under the momentum that went down from the drop of my body. That same momentum is preserved through the lower level swing across the right knee, and the same momentum is preserved up the right side of my body, and then the hands go up above my head, and then as they raise above my head, as they reach the point of my forehead, so my hands are now about, if I was to bend my inner thumb down, it would just about touch my forehead. So my hands are quite close in front of my forehead, but they're not on it. Yeah. And they're higher than my forehead. Now they're top of my forehead, they're forming like an arch. They're still crossed in the half-task position. They're still crossed. And now from that point, they start to open to the left and right. And the palms, the fingers go high and the palms flip over like something unfurling. You know, like you're unrolling a carpet by pulling the loose end of it sharply. You remember when it's Richard Burton unwrapped Cleopatra from the carpet in the movie, yeah? that kind of thing. It's like that. The arms both unfurl left and right as you move your momentum back over to the left. And there, that's the completion of one cycle. Yeah. And then you drop your body, you take that momentum for the completion of that cycle. You simply take that and then you drop it to the left or right again. Okay. Does that make some kind of sense?
And you end up a lot more
with your palms upwards. Yeah. So it's the action is like unfurling. Like unfurling is the best English word I can think of to describe that.
Yeah. So our hands are in the haptas position above our foreheads. When we're coming to the left, our hands unfurl by sort of, there's only one way they can unfurl. So,
well, yeah, the point is they unfurl out to the sides, outwards. You know, I don't hold my arms at 180 degrees, so they're not, for me, they're not going out perfectly to the sides. Mm. Incidentally, if you do this with a bonfire, which is awesome, if you do this exercise with the bonfire, you simply stand facing the bonfire. Yeah.
Yeah.
For this part of it. There are, again, Dalgach, just like Buchking Hengrik, has many levels and many variations. And we're going to talk about some of these, but you've just faced the bonfire as you're doing this. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the movement. Now, that's not the technique, though. The technique has to, obviously, it's a AMSCA level technique. It has to do with the breath. So you need to habituate that movement You need to habituate that movement so that you don't have to think about it. And this is why I say you don't go left, you don't go right when you do the initial drop, because that's thinking. Yeah. You want to get in a place where you go where you feel. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether you go left or right. You know, if you feel like doing 4,000 on the left, then that's what happens. Yeah. It's a very, very spontaneous thing. And the nature and character of this, as you get used to it, the nature and character of that cycle changes, it ebbs and flows. For instance, you get backswings, you get eddies, you get currents, you get various other things coming out in it spontaneously. The key point is the movement is continuous. There's no breaks in the movement. You remember Tyrak, Tyrak, Tyrak. We definitely don't want that. It's fluid and continuous.
Tyrak is a cutting, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm not slagging down Tyrak. Tyrak is useful in its place, but not in Dalgek. You don't use it in Dalgek at all.
For the benefit of our listeners, Tyrak is, say, we go to the, if we just move our way to the left and then we completely stop the movement and bring it back to the right.
That would be Tyrak.
Yeah.
You don't stop moving. Yeah. How fast is the movement? Now, here's the difficult bit of Dalgek, yeah? It's the two different ways to look at it. One is it's done with the breathing, yeah? Mm-hmm. It's done with the breathing. But I'm not going to tell you what the breathing is, because the first bit is to find out what the breathing is, okay? So this is part of this is the first level of the Dalgek exercise, is to find out what the breathing is. Now, what you mean, you're not going to tell me how to breathe? No, I'm definitely not, because this is the Dalgek exercise. The point is, if you're in a state of chalicity, that means you're not thinking about your breathing, then you will be breathing in a very natural way, the way that your body wants you to breathe as you do that movement, as you do the exercise. But also, if you're in a good state of chalicity, you will be aware of what your body's doing at a level. You'll be aware. You'll understand, not on the baseline, you'll understand in the midline what your body is doing. So in a way, even though you're not thinking about the breathing, you'll know what the breathing is if your telicity is good enough. So what I want you to do is do this movement without thinking about the breathing, and yet on the midline, not the baseline, find out what your breathing is. Yeah. What breathing do you do with the technique, but what breathing does the technique make you do? Yeah. And it's not really what it makes you do. And there's no baseline answer to that. I'm not asking for a baseline answer. We're not going to come with a multi choice, you know, quiz. Is it A, B, C? Because what you'll find is there is a complexity there. There's a big complexity there in terms of the nature of Dalgek and the nature of how it exactly works. But what you want to understand is not so much, you know, am I breathing in? Am I breathing out? That's not the answer to the question. The answer to the question is, how does your breath lock into that motion? Lock into the energy of that movement, and you will feel energy in that movement. If you're in a state of chalicity, you start practicing Dalgek, even if you're not very very attuned to the subtleties of energy within animism, there's no problem with Dalgek, because the energy is huge. Once you habituate that technique, it's one of the most obvious places to see energy. You know what we mean by energy.
Yeah.
It's one of the most obvious places to see energy in the whole of shamanism. Dalgek is so obvious. It's powerful. It's like a wave. In terms of the eight trigrams, that would be Squall. That would be the yin baseline, the solid midline, and the solid top line. When we come up the trigrams, we'll go back over this.
So you mentioned squalor. What would be that term in Chinese, just so our audience know that we're on the same page?
That's shun or sun in Chinese.
Okay, cool.
So it's not important. Just since we'd mentioned the eight trigrams the last time or time before, I can't remember, I thought I'd just mention that. The movement must be continuous, but it must teach you. Remember we said we're trying to gain feedback from nature, and we're trying to put ourselves in positions where nature is feeding back to us. And at the Amskar level, this is simply within our own body. which is probably the easiest place. It's like our door in. It's our door into the world of shamanism. But it's like, what I really want to stress is it's not you doing it. It is teaching you. So you for this exercise, in a certain extent, until it's become habituated, you can't actually learn. It is an exercise until it's been habituated. Once it's habituated, then it can start to be a technique. It starts to teach you. So I'd say that's why I distinguish between exercise and technique. Exercise is something that helps you along. It's like, it's a bit like a catalyst. Yeah. You could say that psychoactive substances are an exercise. Yeah. For instance, a bit like a catalyst, but a technique is something more than that. A technique is something that puts you in a position where nature teaches you directly. So first habituate the movement without worrying about it too much. And then in a state of chillicity, you then start to allow the movement to teach you about yourself. It teaches you about yourself, about your breathing, how your breathing locks into that movement, not just locks into the physical movement, but locks into the energy of the movement. The way in which the technique affects you is driven by what you are on the midline and in a certain extent on the top line. You don't want the technique to be driven by what you think you are on the baseline.
Yeah.
That's the first sort of level of Dilgach. You can then, once you get on with it, you can then practice actually Dilgach with the drum. Which is very interesting. You could unfurl the drum. You could unfurl the drum if you want. But you can do the same wave-like motion just with your body. Do exactly the same wave-like motion with your body. And by the time it's habituated, what you'll find is what I'm talking about is there is variation, spontaneous variation coming from the satal. If you're in chillicity, and you habituate the movement, you will find spontaneous variation going on in that wave. It's not a bland, boring wave. There are cycles and swirls and rollbacks. You know, just like when the wave crashes on the beach, it doesn't run smoothly back into the sea. You get countercurrents as it picks up the pebbles on the beach. There's sort of this countercurrent, like an undertow, so something of that nature. You know, the water has complexity. When water flows in a stream, it just doesn't flow with a perfectly smooth surface. It ebbs and whirls and ripples. And in Dilgach, when you get into it, you'll find a lot of this kind of stuff starts happening. Don't resist that. Don't try and make Dilgach conform, for goodness sake. Dilgach is not something you try to conform to a model. Yeah. It's not like a ballroom dancing or anything where your head has to be up on you. No, just the opposite. What you want to do is habituate it to the point where nature is flowing through you. Nature is expressing itself. Nature, I mean, is in terms of the biological nature of your body, and the energy within your body and the breath that's coming from the outside and it allow that to teach you. And this kind of, you know, this lightweight observation we talked about, this lightweight observation, like you're observing an animal that you want to take on as a spirit animal in a state of chillicity, the way you're observing the animal, that's how you observe yourself in a state of chillicity. You're not analyzing it on the baseline, but you are learning what's going on there. You do know in the midline what your breath is. You're not ignorant of that. You're not ignorant of the energy within your body. You're using the very, very obvious, heavy energetic power in the Dilgach technique to start to teach you how to pick up on other ways that your body and nature use energy that are far more subtle than the way it's done in the Dilgach technique. So if you like, Dilgach is like an in-your-face kind of shamanistic technique. So when you do it with a drum, you don't necessarily unfold your hands because you can leave the drum there so you can actually beat it. You're doing the Dilgach technique, and you can't, and then once you get just holding the drum, you can unfurl it if you want, but the reason for not unfurling it is that in the next level of Delgek technique, we're going to start to combine this exercise with, guess what, Bokki and Hengrek, yeah? Mm. We're going to be beating the drum, either on the breath or on the heartbeat, while we're doing the Delgek exercise, yeah? And in which case, you don't want to unfurl it, you want to stay in the half-task position with the drum, yeah?
Crikey.
And you just do the motion with your body, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. Crikey. This was my reaction to this stuff. When I started to find out just how big a subject shamanism was, I thought, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness me.
Was this introduced to you very slowly?
Yeah, it was. It was. It was introduced to me originally, it was introduced to me in the context of other things that I was learning from my guide as well. Mm. It wasn't the only thing I was learning from my guide. So it was introduced in a certain context. Guides that I've had later on in life and guides that I still have today, it's been introduced to me in a more pure form more quickly, than it was that original time. Mm. Things have been introduced to me more quickly, but yeah, there's no hurry. You don't want to be in a hurry. An author, Japanese author, Yukio Mishima, that's his pen name anyway, who I really like his books. I'm not a great, I don't read much. And I think shamanism has moved me away from reading, something. I don't read much. But he
not surprising.
Said,
I've seen your book collection. Jesus.
Yeah, no, but if you analyze my book collection, you'll find there's an awful lot of reference works in it. I read original sources, you know, the number of times I've read, which I don't count as reading. Yeah.
That's
the
difference.
I don't read much. Let's qualify. I don't read much fiction and I don't read many secondary sources. I read a lot of primary sources. So, for instance, Chemical Wedding, Christian Rosenkreutz, Furusaki, I've read those things hundreds of times, but these days, I mean, but anyway, what Mishima said was one of the things that, don't get me wrong, don't think that I identify with all the things Mishima did in his life. Some of them were not that great, but what he said that I thought was good is we're never in such command of a journey as when we're busy with preparations for it. And this is what I said about shamanism. You move on with shamanism. When we start out with this miasmatic ambition to get good at it, to get to become a great shaman, to get to the upper levels. And when you get on with shamanism, what happens is you get to a point where you start looking back and thinking, it's not wonder that's in front of me. It's wonder that's behind me. Wonder and the tremendous, beautiful, amazing, stunning, awe-inspiring nature of shamanism. A lot of that is sitting behind you, not in front of you in that journey. And the joy that it is joyful. It's a joyful activity. Japanese shamaness that we talked about before, she called it Yoki Yusan. Yeah. Mm. Yoki means like yo is like yang. Yeah. You know, we talk about yin and yang, like positive. And ki is chi, it's energy, positive energy. Yeah. Yu is playing. Yu is toshiltin, if you like. There's a Japanese word for toshiltin. Yu. And san is the mountains. You know, it's like that child we talked about chasing butterflies in the mountain. Yoki Yusan. Beautiful, beautiful phrase. It's like that. As I said, you know, animistic people, animistic, you know, my definition of people can include wolves and various other animals. They take a joy in their interaction with nature and that's just what this stuff is about to a great extent. We are learning. That's the thing that makes it shamanism. We're learning a lot from it. We're learning things that other people, in inverted commas, don't learn in their lives. But actually, it's also a joyful activity. It's a joyous activity. Joe, we're coming up on the hour again.
I was about to say, just enjoying it.
But say is that if you're practicing this technique with a bonfire, If this is another level of it, just briefly, and I'll just mention it. You practicing this technique with a bonfire. You don't get roasted on one side. That's a bit of a joke. But if you come to a time where the satel tells you to move, tells you to physically move because of the radiant energy from the bonfire, when you do that, you just step. You step one of your feet either to the left or to the right. After you've opened into Tirucht. And as you do that, you turn your back on the bonfire and you come to the completely standard folded wings position, Haftas, the completely ordinary, not standard, ordinary folded wing position, just like the Tiln exercise. And you can just stay there and practice your Chalisti with your back to the bonfire until you feel ready to go again. In which case you step one of your feet and as you open out, you do the movement as you turn and you open out into Tirucht facing the bonfire again, and then off you go again. Yeah, doing Delgech. And if you do that continuously in one direction, so I turn to my right when I close up with my back to the bonfire, and then I turn to my right again as I open up, you can go around the bonfire in a circle, and sometimes that's quite nice as you're practicing Delgech. It's quite nice. And actually, I quite enjoy that kind of thing. And then, as a spiritual, as a satel leads you, you're going left or right. There's no order to it. It just happens like that. Yeah. So, you don't think I do this with a bonfire all the time. I don't. It takes some organization, a bonfire. But when I do, it's lovely. It's absolutely lovely. It's a wonderful way to practice Delgech. And actually, just practice the movement, develop Delgech, habituate it. And then you'll be when you do come to do it with a bonfire, you'll be in a much better position to appreciate that. Yeah. And actually, taking it beyond that, practicing your Chalisti, talking about, standing at the edge of the ocean, at the edge of a lake, the bonfire is no different from that. The bonfire itself will teach you when you get on with Delgech. The bonfire itself teaches you, because the bonfire is a living thing. It's an energy change, and as you're probably trying to realize, all this stuff is all about energy change.
Fantastic. All right then, Damon, shall we call it a day there then?
Yeah, two techniques, two episodes. There's going to be quite a few.
That's fine. Can keep these going as long as it takes. Okay. Right, thanks very much for listening, guys. Head on over to the website wovenenergy.com, where you can sign up and get yourself a Get Started episode over there. You can also, we can keep in touch, and I keep telling you when new episodes are out and what the episodes are about, etc., and give you hints and tips and all that kind of stuff. So make sure you sign up. Thanks for listening, and make sure you send any questions you have to joe@wovenenergy.com. That's joe@wovenenergy.com. And we'll try and put another Q&A session together where we can get your questions answered. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.